So last time we talked about in a very dense lecture, I gave you basically a flash flood of information about supersymmetry. Now there are things to consider. Let's rewrite down the superpotential. So when you write down the superpotential, you have terms like this. You have the Yukawas. H down, D. H down, LE. Plus some other Yukawas. Okay. Prime. And the DD plus, let's put this one, double prime, triple prime, and then we have a kappa, LH up. So, first of all, because of supersymmetric, because we want this to be holomorphic in supersymmetry, we need to add an extra Higgs doublet, so that extends the particle content of the standard model, besides of the doubling of particles that happens automatically because we have supersymmetry. Now, exactly because we've added the extra multiplets, and because of the fact we added scalars, we are allowed to add extra couplings that violate baryon and lepton number. Now, if we want to remove these with our parity, we need to impose a new symmetry or parity, and this automatically tells you some things. So what does it tell you? First of all, if you were to write, let's say, what vertices this type of coupling would imply. So in the standard model, this cannot give rise to a marginal operator interaction between fermions. But here it would mean that I have, let's say, an up-type quark, an up-type squark scalar, and two down-type quarks, okay? So it would mean that I could have one, in a vertex, I would have one Suzy particle with two standard model particles. The moment I forbid these couplings, you will see now that it automatically implies a very nice mnemonic for Fermi, for Feynman diagrams. So, for example, if I have the interaction of an electron with a photon, okay, the coupling, all I have to do, the moment I forbid these two couplings and I impose our parity, I recover the Suzy interaction vertex by replacing the two particles with their Suzy counterparts, okay? And this coupling now is related to this coupling by supersymmetry. So you can get all the Suzy vertices by just replacing in any standard model diagram two standard model particles for two Suzy particles. And that only happens after you impose our parity, okay? It's a good mnemonic to have about Suzy interactions. Now, because of Suzy breaking, we add other terms to this. Nevertheless, supersymmetry is a very constraining theory, and it tells us that the Higgs mass has to be less or equal, because the Higgs quartic now is constrained, which is the Z mass, okay? So another prediction of supersymmetry at tree level is that the Higgs is light, okay? So again, the things to remember is we double the particle spectrum of the standard model. We need to impose a new symmetry in order for the protons to decay. The moment we do that, Every vertex of the standard model gives you a Suzy vertex by replacing two standard model particles with two Suzy particles. And the other prediction is the Higgs mass at real level is less than 90 GeV. Okay? Not great. This is not good, okay? Clearly.
So there, yeah. Those diagrams exist, right?
No. Yes, yes, yes. So you have everything, right? Yeah. So Suzy, in fact, the moment you impose Suzy, it's a very constraining theory. Not only both diagrams exist, these couplings are set by the gauge coupling. Okay? Now I need to show you stuff. So the other thing that because of this are parity, now you see another thing. You can only produce Suzy particles in pairs. Okay? Which is crucial. It means I cannot destroy them ultimately. So this property that you replace every two standard model particles with two Suzy particles automatically implies that the lightest supersymmetric particle is stable. And usually, because of the way Suzy, because of models of how Suzy is broken, it turns out that the lightest supersymmetric particle is the one that has the least amount of charge. So which ones that have the least amount of charge? The Bino, the neutral partner of the B boson, the Wino. And this is what gave rise to the WIMP. They still have weak interactions, and they're stable, okay? And as I think Jun Wu will discuss this, this is what gave rise to the WIMP paradigm and gave rise to designing all sorts of experiments to look for the lightest supersymmetric particle is a dark matter candidate. Now, how do you look for Suzy? So because you always produce these guys in pairs, okay, you can have electrons here, you can have quarks here. So at the LHC, for example, you collide protons. These are composite particles. Let's say you produce gluinos. You have to produce two at the same time, two Suzy particles. It can be a gluino and a scalar. It can be different combinations of stuff. So you have two gluinos now, because these guys have a huge charge, they have color charge, they're usually heavy. So they will decay to other Suzy particles. So they will decay, for example, to a quark and a squark. And ultimately, this will decay, for example, to the photino, okay? Or whatever the lightest Suzy particle is. So this is another quark. So what are these things? So this guy has no charge, okay? So when it is produced and goes through the detector, you never see it. So these guys appear as lost or missing energy in the collision. Okay? So if you were to, you know roughly what the initial energy of the quark constituents of the proton are. So that gives you some idea of how much energy you should have. And you see that there is some missing. Okay? So one of the big signatures of Suzy is exactly this missing energy. And in fact, every time you see missing energy searches in a collider, it usually means you're looking for a stable particle, meaning that they usually tag these as dark matter searches. Okay, even though all you can say is that the particle is stable in lab at the scale, doesn't decay inside the detector. But this is a standard now search in colliders. Okay? What else does this infant have? It has these quarks here. So if you produce quarks, because of confinement in QCD, they cannot be free colored particles, so they have to hadronize. So this gives rise to what they call jets. Okay? So one of the standard searches, this tells you one of the standard searches, which is jets plus energetic jets, right? You have multi-TeV. So these are 14 TeV, 7 and 7, colliding. Or I guess it's 13, 6.5 and 6.5. And missing energy. Okay? So this is a standard search that looks for colored particles. Jets plus missing energy.
Okay.
Now, yeah?
Could you remind me like why the lightest superparticle cannot carry charge?
Well, if you want it to be, it doesn't have to, but if you want it to be dark matter, it better not carry charge.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You're right, it doesn't have to. There are models of supersymmetry where the lightest guy is charged, yeah. But that is stable, and you better not be, that is excluded by data, right?
Yeah.
But in principle, yeah, you're right. There are models that people have constructed where the lightest guy could be charged, but it usually doesn't happen because of what I told you. When you look at the Susi breaking scenario and the way the soft parameters run, you see that usually it's the lightest guys are the ones with the least charge. Okay? So now if you were to substitute these things with charged winos or selectrons, then you could have a combination of jets and leptons in the final state. So the moment you see jets plus missing energy, leptons plus missing energy, those are usually Susi searches. Okay? And let's see some results. Okay. Start.
So Mina, so this is a mnemonic, right? So if I have interaction in the standard model, change just two particles into superparticles, and that's, I have that interaction, and nothing more.
And in principle, nothing more. Yes, there is, in principle, nothing more, because there is the little caveat that of the when you write down the so I didn't write here the soft breaking terms, but when you break supersymmetry, you can generate the A terms. Which are, for example, you can have the H up. This is a scalar now. The up type quark, the left-handed up type quark, right-handed up type quark, and these are of course flavor dependent here. So this is a massive vertex, right? So in principle, you can have things like this. Okay. But as you see, it still involves two. This is now Susi breaking, but it still involves two particles. Okay. But this is the one case where this coupling is not directly related to the Yukawa because it breaks Susi. This is the little caveat. But it still has the rule that I substitute two particles for two standard model particles. Okay. So this is a okay. You're not supposed to do that. Okay, great. So this is a plot that shows a search for gluinos, like the one I showed you before. So this has jets and missing energy. And here in particular, it has B quarks in the final state. And then you see how they present their exclusions so far. So this is the mass of the gluino.
Yeah.
Okay. So it goes roughly up to 2 TeV here, you see. And this is the mass of the neutralino, which is the lightest guy. And goes up to also close to a TeV. Okay. And in fact, this is a summary plot. So this is a summary plot, unfortunately, of constraints. So all of these things that you see, this is the mass scale, it's north of a TeV. Which is quite unfortunate, okay? So by all indications, in collider searches, the scale of supersymmetry is above a TeV.
So neutralino should be about TeV.
Eh?
Neutralino should be about TeV.
If it's produced through a colored particle, yes. If you look at direct production of charginos and neutralinos, because they're electroweak particles, they can be lighter than a TeV. So the most constrained stuff at the LHC is because you're colliding protons, right? It's colored particles. So anything that has a colored charge is constrained to be roughly above a TeV. Okay? You have to play a lot with parameters to get. Now, charginos, the constraints, and neutralinos are not things that don't have a color charge, are not as constrained, but they're not doing much better. Now, there is another thing that is even more constraining in SUSY, in principle, in general, and it came even before the LHC. And that is, of course, a flavor violation and CP violation. So remember last time, so to these soft terms, we have the scalar masses, right? So we have, for example, quark squared and all the other terms. What else do we add? We also have the Gugino masses. They're usually written as lambda. So when you count the parameters of the surface, so the standard model parameters, the superpotential, because you're constrained to get the standard model couplings, don't really have new parameters other than this term in principle, but these guys do. Okay, so and because you have here, I simplified it too much. In principle, I should have dagger I. And the same matrices that diagonalize this one doesn't have to be the same matrices that diagonalize the Yukawa matrices. So that means you have new mixing angles, yeah, between quarks. You also have new phase CP phases. Okay? And so in direct searches now, so if you look for fundamental electric dipole moments of particles like the neutron, place very severe constraints on the SUSY spectrum. Another one that plays severe constraints, in fact, in some cases, more severe constraints than CP than EDM searches, is flavor violation. And that comes, for example, in the KK bar mixing. Okay? Now, in the standard model, if you remember, you had the diagram that looked like DS. You had W's here, you had, for example, the charm here on the top, or the up. Same here. And then you had S and D. Okay? So this is, now you can take these things as a substitute for their SUSY partners. Okay? Or for the Gluino, for example, you could have this diagram. So in SUSY, you have more particles. So this can be the Gluino, for example. These are the These should be here now. These guys. These are the mass the masses of the squarks, the soft terms, Gluino. And then you get this. Okay? So to whatever was causing KK bar mixing, now you have a slew of other things that will do that. So if you assume that mixing parameters, like CP violating phases and mixing mixing angles are of order one, you find that the scale of SUSY, the SUSY particles, has to be larger than 100 to 1,000. TV. Okay? Now, this is not just bad for SUSY, by the way. Every time, like composite Higgs models, every time. So the fact that you have these three mixing angles plus one CP violating phases that are allowed by the flavor symmetries and the gauge structure of the standard model, the moment you expand that, it's very easy to just destroy everything. For example, in the if the standard model didn't have had two families, there wouldn't be any CP violation. So KK bar mixing would be completely forbidden with two flavors. So the moment you extend the particle content, everything just goes in disarray. And this is just, again, SUSY gets the bad rap because you can actually, it's a weakly coupled theory, so you can do calculations. But if you look at composite Higgs models, RS, anything that, everything runs into the same trouble. So the question is, where is SUSY? Okay. And in fact, even before, as I said, even before the LHC, it is a more powerful probe because this is too, you can imagine you have flavor symmetries, you have extra symmetries in the theory that suppress these contributions. Nevertheless, as you saw from the CKM matrix, the CP violating phase in the CKM matrix is order one. It's not small. So where is SUSY? So then, this has been an issue since the early 2000s. This has been an issue for a while because people have been studying KK bar mixing since the 60s. So they know the properties, they measure it very well. It's a beautiful thing. So people said, okay, what happened? Let's go back. Let's go back to our discussion of the hierarchy problem. What did we forget? Well, there is one problem people forgot, cosmological constant problem, which is even worse, okay? In principle, if you were, you can quantify the amount of fine tuning in your theory by taking the ratio of the Higgs mass, the weak scale, divided by the scale of new physics square. Okay? And in SUSY, this is somewhere, depending on what prefactor you put, people sometimes put a loop factor to facilitate things. So this can be anything between 10%, 1%, which I think is more realistic, to 10%. Okay? Now, let's go back to the cosmological constant problem. As we discussed, the expectation is that the universe is yay big. So this is at least a 60 order of magnitude fine-tuning that people left out. And the only one that took it seriously was Weinberg. And he did his crazy anthropic argument. And he said, okay, let's go back. And he looked back and he did his crazy anthropic. He said, okay, if I start varying the amount of cosmological constant I find in the universe, it's very easy not to have any galaxies anymore. So we are very close to the value that you need, that is maximally allowed value of the cosmological constant, in order to have galaxies. Okay? Now, the question is, what structure would allow such a thing? So the way we imagine, so because gravity is sensitive to all energy, so people say, okay, so we have some scalar field configuration, even let's say the Higgs, right? So the Higgs has a minimum that in order for it to give rise to the cosmological constant we observe, this needs to be 10 to the minus 60 times the weak scale to the fourth. Okay? The natural value of you expect the vacuum energy of the Higgs potential to be. Now, if you only had one vacuum, this is clearly an accident. There is no dynamics. So the natural thing to say, oh, what if I had many vacua, okay? Then accidentally, I might be found myself into one. I wouldn't consider it much of a, depending on the number of vacua, if I had enough, then by accident, we are here. So, saying that there is an anthropic argument is not enough. You still need some sort of theory framework that would allow some sort of scanning for the cosmological constant. Now, in our universe, for things like the Earth-Sun distance, there is automatically the fact that you have many suns, many stars. So the question is, what type of theory gives you such a picture? And turns out there is such a theory. And it goes by the name of string theory. Okay? So string... Oh, not this one. So, in the early 2000s, I think it was exactly 2000, Pusso and Polchinski showed that string theory can have as many as, and even more, vacua. Okay? So huge numbers of vacua. People were not happy, okay? So they arise because in string theory, you start with 10 dimensions, right? You need extra dimensions to make the theory mathematically consistent. The moment you turn on fluxes in these extra dimensions to compactify the structure and give rise to four dimensions, you end up with all sorts of field configurations. Okay? And at first, string theory was proposed to unify quantum mechanics and gravity. So it was supposed, the promise was string theory will explain everything. You have a master equation, you write it down, it gives you everything that you need. Well, it turns out that wasn't the case. In fact, they had the exact opposite prediction. And it put a lot of, actually, I have to say, that was a revolution for many reasons. It's a seminal paper because it changed the way people view string theory. And Now, and it changed the way people think about problems, okay? If you think that there is a chance that string theory is correct, then it automatically gives rise to a natural picture where Weinberg's argument could be true. Yes.
But did they show that there are like dynamical transitions between the vacuum, right? Because I think they only showed.
Well, good. So this is the thing. So then it started. Okay, now you want to go back to the theory that no one wants to remember. So people started talking about eternal inflation. So the way you would populate those vacua is through, during an inflationary period, through quantum fluctuations. Okay? So you don't necessarily have to have tunneling at low energies from one vacuum to the other. You could have, even if you have eternal inflation, you can have very, very rare events happening. And there was an entire discussion about trying to make a picture where the most likely outcome of populating the landscape is that you end up most time here. Okay? So it became known as the measure problem. In fact, the idea of eternal inflation, Andre Linde had in the 90s, before the string landscape. He was in fact convinced that quantum fluctuation should dominate the inflation. So people usually talk about inflation as a classical slow roll. But he knew that there is a regime where quantum fluctuations will be important. So the moment that happens, you're in the eternal inflating regime, and you lose complete control of the theory.
What do you mean by eternal inflation?
I mean that phi dot over phi is less than Hubble. So if you have a scalar field and slow rolls, right? So this is phi dot, this is velocity basically, the rate of it's changing. But at the same time, every Hubble time it jumps, there is quantum fluctuations of order Hubble. So if the rate of change of each Hubble time is less than Hubble, then the motion of this field, it's like a random walk. It's no longer a classical slow roll. So this is the statement that this is the eternal inflation. Okay? So it became for 10 years, many prominent string theorists around the world thought about the measure problem, how you populate the landscape. Okay? And I mean, to tell you the truth, I think it was a big, they didn't get far. They had conjectures, they tried to do toy models of the landscape. But it's not clear even that is important. As long as you have a mechanism, why do you have to prove that we are special? I mean, I come from Greece. We are 10 million out of 8 billion. So if you look at statistics, I should be here, sitting here and be Chinese or in fact Indian right now. I think the India has more. So the fact that they were trying to make our universe the most likely to happen, it's not clear it's even relevant dynamically. But it changes something that, it changes the nature of the questions we ask, right? The same way that, that before, the size of planetary orbits was, before we knew that stars were like the sun, the size of planetary orbits was a dynamical question. People were writing models to explain why the size of planetary orbits are such that they are. It became a historical accident afterwards, the moment we saw that we have many stars. So it changes the nature of the questions. Okay? Now, is this satisfactory? No. Does it mean we need to stop looking for dynamics? No. The first thing you do is look for dynamics, because we have many examples in our everyday life where naturalist dynamics does work. So now the question is, okay, so it turns out that when they tried, and they showed that, and they have, if you look at that paper, they connected to the cosmological constant problem, Busson and Polchinski, and to Weinberg's paper, and showed the conditions you get to get enough scanning. Now, it turns out But in the first paper they wrote, in this paper, high-scale Susie breaking was favored. Okay? What does it mean, high scale? I'm close to the string scale, very high scale. Not at 100 GV. So the question is now, how do you reconcile the two pictures? So this is where the idea, this is where the idea of split Susie came about. Okay, so now, so we have here the Higgs, okay? An ordinary cell, Susie tells you, okay, you have to have all these particles here. But in split Susie, they said, okay, let's follow the Busopolsky paradigm and let's have most of these particles heavy, okay? So Susie, which can be anything, essentially between 100 or 1 TeV and 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 16 TeV, the Planck scale. And Susie. Now, so in principle, all of them have to be here. Scalars, Fermi, Agiginos, everything up here. Well, they said, wait a minute. Scalars are most likely heavy, okay? And we have one guy tune the Higgs to be at this scale. So one guy remains light, the Higgs, and we will discuss. So they called it this, and the same anthropic argument for the existence of galaxies, the analog argument is the atomic principle that tells you that you need the Higgs to be light, and I will explain what that is. But in principle, the fermions, Gaginos, can be light because they are protected by chiral symmetries. So that automatically saves the WIMP. So you still preserve the dark matter success of supersymmetry, and you also preserve unification. And the reason is that if you look at the particle spectrum of Susie, of the standard model and Susie, the ones that contribute most to the coupling to get unification are the particles that come in non-complete multiplets. So remember when we did unification, we saw that in SU5, the matter fields can be embedded nicely in SU5 multiplets. So those contribute the same in the running of the couplings. The ones that contribute differently are the Higgses, the Higgsinos, and the gauge bosons and the Gaginos. So in fact, the Higgsinos are the most important, turns out. So the moment the Gaginos are light, not only can you preserve the success of, still have the WIMP, which was a great prediction, and at the same time, you preserve unification. Now let's look about the Higgs. So what is the atomic principle? Okay? And already at the time of 2000s, people were looking to expand the idea of Weinberg's. After Weinberg's success, people try to see, are there other parameters of the standard model that are amenable to anthropic arguments? Okay? One of the people, Donahue, wrote many papers. There is Max Tegmark that wrote many papers. Frank Wilczek wrote papers on the topic. So what is the atomic principle? The atomic principle came out of one of those efforts. So we know that the, let's say, the mass of the W, or the weak scale, is at 80 GeV, okay? So now let's keep every other coupling of the standard model the same, meaning the Yukawas. And let's change the Higgs-Bef. Let's make it lighter. Okay? Now, question. What happens to the proton and the neutron in that case?
They like switch places.
Why?
Because one is charged and the other isn't.
Excellent. So that means now that, and I think this here has to be at around, that switchover happens at around, let me see my notes. ¿20 GeV for the W mass. So this has to be 80 GeV. So a factor of 4 below. Because the proton is charged, so and it has charge 1. So the quarks that wants to puff up, this is a repulsive interaction to a contribution to its mass. So the proton-neutron mass difference right now mostly comes from the up and down masses. But as you make those contributions smaller and smaller, you still have contributions from QCD, because QCD confines. This is where most of the mass of those particles come from. But one guy will get a repulsive, meaning a positive, it will be less bound, so.
But you're lowering Higgs, right?
You're lowering the Higgs, but you're changing at the same time, keeping the Yukawas the same, you're changing the up and down masses. So the contributions of the current masses to the proton and neutron is less. So now most of the mass contribution comes from the strong interactions, which should be common roughly to both.
So if I lower Higgs mass, and if I'm leaving Yukawas the same, so it means that like as U decreases, D decreases as well.
Yes.
So difference stays the same, right?
It's not then it gets smaller, but then you have a contribution of size alpha over R to the mass of the proton. You also have roughly 1 MeV of contribution. You have an ENM energy, which is alpha over R contribution to the mass of the proton. This is roughly an MeV.
Okay.
So the moment the up and down masses become less than that, then it's going to be, they become unimportant. So you have to take into account the ENM contribution to the mass of the proton, and there's no such contribution to the mass of the neutron. And that mass wants to make the proton heavier because it's a repulsive contribution. It's less, it counteracts the attractiveness of the strong interactions. Does that make sense? This is roughly an MeV, 2 MeV. Okay? So if the proton is heavier, then you can have proton decay to neutron, and then you don't have not even hydrogen, everything is neutron. So it's a very boring universe, okay? So now the question is, what happens when you start making things heavier, when you start making the Higgs mass, the Higgs waves heavier?
There's going to be some threshold mass, right, where they're equal.
But that's, we are above. That would be somewhere above here. So for us, neutron, a free neutron decays to a proton. A free neutron, okay? A free neutron, remember. So, question. Why don't the neutrons decay inside the nuclei? Because the proton inside nuclei, again, because of the ENM contribution, is heavier. So the threshold, so they don't have, they become so close that there is no available energy to produce an electron. So the neutrons get stabilized inside nuclei. In fact, I know several AMO people that don't know that the neutrons decay. They think it's stable. But that's the everyday experience. So now the question is, what happens if I start making the up and down, the down is heavier than the up, okay? So what happens if I make the mass difference even larger? Eventually, what will happen to nuclei? Inside nuclei?
They'll decay as well.
Yeah, so neutrons will decay inside nuclei. So the moment that happens, I cannot have complex nuclei either. So here, the transition happens at 400 GeV, roughly. So it's a very narrow range if you keep the Yukawa's constant, where the weak scale can be within a factor of 10, roughly, and still have complex nuclei and atoms. So this is the atomic principle. And this is a paper by Donahue in the 1997, I think. Okay?
So at the kinetic scale, neutron is...
Neutron is heavier, free neutron.
Yeah.
Is heavier than the proton.
I'm increasing the scale, so neutron is becoming more...
Even heavier.
Okay, so, and now it can decay.
Inside nuclei.
Nuclei.
That's the key point.
Because it overcomes electromagnetic.
Exactly. It's so much bigger that it overcomes the electromagnetic repulsion. So the threshold for decay, does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay. So you cannot have complex structures. So this is the atomic principle, okay? So it turns out that... But this is the model,
How at that scale, proton and neutron...
At
that scale, does proton and neutron make sense at all?
Yeah, it does make sense, because you still have confinement. I'm
confinement
not saying...
No.
Sorry. The M-up is, in the standard model, is 2 MeV. M-down... is roughly 4 to 5 MeV, okay, 4.8. So this is much lower. So they don't sit at the weak scale. They are lower because of the small Yukawa. So the moment you change these things by a few MeV, they become comparable to the ENM. ENM, this is like, this is 1 over 137 over R, the size of a, remember, it's 200... 1 over 200 MeV. So this is roughly 1 MeV. 1 to 2 MeV, depending on how big of the nucleus is and all that. So the moment these things start changing by order 1, you undo the balance.
Yes, that's fine. I was thinking like about confinement scale, but I guess like once you're...
No, it's log, right?
It drags the confinement scale as well, right?
Yeah, but it's not a big change. That part is not a big change. It's a very small change.
What's the confinement scale now in standard model?
It's like 1 GeV. That's not the important thing, right? If I change the confinement scale overall, all I do is change those masses together. That's not a big problem. The problem is, do I have atoms? In order to have complex atoms, you need complex nuclei.
Okay. Okay.
Yes?
So somehow this tells me that the Higgs cannot be too light, right?
So here, so in one case, when the Higgs becomes too light, the proton decays to neutrons, so I only have neutrons in the universe, so it's a very boring universe. But now if I start making it too heavy, then everything becomes a very simple hydrogen, or in fact, turns out delta plus plus is, there is a baryon that has charge 2 that's actually the lightest, because you do change a bit the properties of QCD. Okay, so this is the atomic principle. Now, one, so what are the signals? Yes?
I see, okay.
So now the question is, what are the signatures of this model? So the smoking gun of this, do you see, actually, yeah, let me lower that. So now look at the gluino decay, okay? So we can still, the gluinos are fermions, so they can be light. So when they are produced at the LHC, the only way, or at the collider, the only way they can decay is through the quarks, Where are the squarks now? Very heavy. So that means that one of the smoking guns of this scenario, if you have heavy scalar super partners, it means that the Gluino in fact, it could be almost stable. Depending if they are at the gut scale, they are like the proton. I mean, they become very, very long-lived. They are collider stable. Now, the question is, given what we know now, where can the scale of Suzy breaking be? So we are allowed to make the scalars heavier, but now we know the Higgs to be 125 GeV. So if we do that, okay, we know there is going to be a contribution to the Higgs quartic that comes from the stop loop now is not cancelled by the stop. So there's going to be a contribution to the Higgs quartic that will make automatically the Higgs heavier. So this gives you a quartic 3/4 y top to the fourth log of m Suzy breaking of the scalar partners divided by I think it's pi square here pi m top here. So if you calculate what contribution on top of the Suzy contribution you need, you find that m Suzy M scalar has to be anywhere between 10 and 1,000 TeV. Okay? In fact, if you take into account gauge coupling unification into account, then you find that then M scalar has to be less than 100 TeV. So, which tells you that if you were to build in this model an even higher energy machine, like what they're talking about, then they should be within reach. So there is a small hierarchy of scales. There cannot be any more. When the model was first proposed, the scale of Suzy breaking could be very high. But turns out that the 125 plus unification tells you that the Higgs mass has to be somewhere there. Okay? Now, there are other signatures. So the Gluino lifetime is one. So now, actually, let's do a lifetime. Can you tell me, do an estimate of the Gluino lifetime? So how would you do that? So tell me what I put here. So there is a numerator, there is a denominator.
Is it going to decay through the superpartner?
Yeah. Well, the superpartner, look at the diagram there. The superpartner is heavy.
Yes.
Okay? So let's say it's much heavier than the Gluino. So can you write down what is the... Can you do me an estimate, a quick estimate? This is not equal, it's squiggly. So if I were to estimate the Gluino mass in this model, how... The squark is much heavier than the Gluino. So what is the lifetime estimate that you would write? Dimensional analysis. Okay?
Mass to Gluino to the fifth or something, right? And then I have mass of the thing in decays through to the fourth.
Well, where does the mass to the fifth go to? Okay, tell me, and I write.
I guess the numerators.
Yeah. Okay, but what goes here? This is the Gluino mass to the fifth.
Yeah.
What goes here?
Superpartner.
Which was superpartner? Because there are many superpartners.
I mean, the next lightest superpartner.
No.
I mean, scalar. It has to be up everywhere.
You have to integrate out the scalar, right? So it has to be the scalar guy, right? It's the squark mass to the fourth. Right? So now that becomes a contact interaction because the squark is heavy on that diagram. Right? I integrate it out. The propagator is never on shell. Why are you puzzled by this?
Wait, but isn't the squark the superpartner or am I confused?
No. Yeah, it is, but it's heavy, right? That's the point about split. The scalars are heavy, fermions are light. So in the diagram, so if this diagram of the decay, this is a three-body decay, right? In reality, when the quarks, when the scorps become very heavy, the diagram looks like this. I have a gluino. I have this vertex here. I have the photino, and I have two jets coming out. Okay, that's it's a three-body decay. Now this vertex here should be it's the propagator of the quark when I integrate it out. Now in the amplitude, it's 1 over m quark squared, but in the rate, it's the fourth, it's the square of the amplitude. You're looking at me, so confused.
Yeah, because I thought that I somehow said it, but I didn't, so now I'm confused.
No, you stole me the next slide, the super pattern, but oh, not okay. This guy.
So it's, oh, okay, I see it. Okay.
You told me this guy. It has to be the heavy guy, right?
Okay.
Of course, there's the strong coupling. Now, for phase space, what do I put here? So for a two-body decay, 4 pi. For three-body decay, an additional loop factor, 4 pi times 16 pi squared. Turns out it's 1 cubed. Okay? But every time you add another particle in the final phase space, is a loop factor. That's the mnemonic, a massless, right? Because in principle, what I should put there is the available energy for the decay. Let's assume that the photino is massless here, okay? So when you do the math, you get something that can be the sigma tau, the can be something like a few centimeters to a meter. So the things decay inside the detector now. So people have searches in place to look for these guys, okay? And this is, in fact, the smoking gun of split, one of the smoking guns. And right now, I think this is the best chance. Models like this are the best chance for SUSY, unfortunately. Everything else looks really bad. So automatically, when you make the scalars heavy, you see the diagram for KG bar mixing? Problem solved. Everything is heavy. So automatically, all the problems with CP violation, flavor, are automatically solved, okay? So, yeah, maybe this is the best chance for supersymmetry right now. But anyway, that's the status. Next time, we do extra dimensions, okay? And that's it. Thank you, guys. Thank you for your questions.
Okay, one more. So,
yeah.
When people say this 10 to the 500 vacua, do they have like fixed asymptotics? Like, is the cosmological constant, like, does it have only positive sign or do they also count?
Oh, yeah, yeah, they have all sorts of, yeah, they have everything.
Okay, so it's only positive CC vacua.
What that we care about. And there is an entire discussion about those. They have all sorts of things. They have positive CC, they have negative CC, they have everything.
Because if they have negative CC, then probably I cannot like tunnel through like from positive to negative CC, right?
It's not clear. You may. So this is a huge discussion. So there were models. Oh boy, this has to do with how SUSY is broken and how there is an entire discussion about the cosmological evolution and how you count these vacua in your measure problem. But they should be there. They should be there. Anyway, can discuss more of this online because this takes another direction. Okay? It's a good question though.